Katra Podcast Conversations for the curious essential knowledge, simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're here to cut through the noise, bring you some profound insights. Today, we're really embarking on a journey diving into a truly monumental work, Heinrich Zimmer's Philosophies of India.
Huge book.
Yeah. It really is. Yeah. And it's not just, you know, a historical text. Yeah. We see it as this profound map for understanding ourselves. And frankly, it kind of redefined how the West even started to grapple with Eastern thought,
mm-hmm.
our mission today. Well, it's to unpack some of that incredible wisdom and see how relevant it still feels for you right now.
And that's such a critical point he makes right from the start. Zimmer challenges this whole idea of philosophy being just some dry academic thing.
Yeah.
He shows Indian philosophy as a, well, he calls it a science of consciousness transformation.
Wow.
Yeah, a really rigorous, systematic approach, all designed to achieve self-realization, liberation from suffering. And think about it, in our world today, saturated with information, just constant chaos.
Tell me about it.
These ancient insights, they're not just fascinating history. They actually offer, you know, genuine practical shortcuts to some really deep understanding.
Heinrich Zimmer himself, I mean, what a figure, right?
Yeah.
Born 1890, German Indologist, linguist, art historian. He properly mastered Sanskrit and Pali.
Incredible depth.
What really strikes me about him is this blend. You've got the rigorous academic scholarship, definitely, but also this deep intuitive understanding. It wasn't just translating words. It felt like he was translating the soul of the ideas.
That's a great way to put it.
That's a rare gift, would you say? And we really owe a debt to Joseph Campbell, too, for editing his work after he died, making sure Zimmer's vision lived on. And you can definitely see the influence of Carl Jung in there, too, right? The collective unconscious stuff.
Absolutely. It was an extraordinary gift. And what's fascinating, just like you said, is that Zimmer wasn't just a translator of texts. He was translating meaning, translating experience for a Western audience specifically.
Building bridges.
Exactly. He built this vital bridge connecting these, let's face it, complex spiritual concepts with psychological frameworks people could actually relate to. He saw all of Indian culture, the art, the myths, the texts, not as separate things,
right,
but as deeply interconnected facets of one single quest, the big quest for truth and transformation. Though I wonder, did he maybe risk over-psychologizing it sometimes, you know, and trying to make it accessible?
That's a really fair question.
Yeah.
I think, though, his genius was showing how these ancient Indian systems already were profoundly psychological. Like way before modern Western psychology even got going.
Good point.
He just used those Jungian lenses, perhaps, to help Western minds see that inherent psychological depth. So the book's core purpose, then, it really becomes this comprehensive gateway.
Yeah.
A way into understanding these Indian philosophical traditions, showing them as incredibly sophisticated systems.
Mm-hmm.
Systems offering practical solutions to, well, universal human problems, guiding us on a journey, you could say, from the worldly to the transcendent.
Exactly. And the central thesis, the main idea, is that Indian philosophy is fundamentally soteriological.
Okay, big word. What does that mean, basically?
Yeah, sounds academic, but it just means it's concerned with salvation or liberation, you know?
Yeah.
It's all about achieving a darshana.
Darshana.
Which means a seeing or vision of truth, but not just intellectual understanding. It's a direct transformative insight, something that fundamentally shifts your consciousness and leads you to ultimate freedom. Or moksha.
A moksha, right.
So this is an abstract theory. It's this integrated pursuit weaving together myth, psychology, metaphysics, all into one holistic path towards inner freedom.
So, okay, zooming out a bit then.
Yeah.
This big goal, moksha, liberation.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean for all the different systems Zimmer talks about? Because there are quite a few. Do they all kind of point the same way, even if the paths look different?
They absolutely do. That's one of Zimmer's key points. While the approaches vary wildly, I mean really wildly sometimes, all these Indian systems share that common goal, freeing consciousness from identifying with that limited ego-bound awareness.
Okay.
Think of it like liberating your true self from the, you know, the smaller everyday self that gets tangled up in all the world's dramas.
Right. Makes sense. But hang on, before we get to total liberation, Zimmer also talks about something called the philosophy of success. What's that about? Is that more grounded, more earthly?
Yes, precisely. And it's a crucial starting point. He doesn't just jump to the end goal. This part delves into the, let's call them, worldly aims of Hindu life. It recognizes that, you know, before you can transcend the world, you kind of have to live in it properly.
Okay. So what are those aims?
Well, you have dharma, that's righteous duty, ethical conduct, basically living a good moral life. Then there's artha, That covers material prosperity, wealth, power, building a stable life, security.
Right.
And finally, comma, that's aesthetic and sensual pleasure, enjoying the richness life offers. And these aren't seen as bad things at all. No, not inherently. The ashrama system, the four stages of life, student, householder, forest dweller, renunciant, that provides the structure. It's a journey for pursuing these goals within the world, but in a balanced way, gradually shifting the focus from, you know, external stuff to more internal understanding as you go through life.
That's fascinating. It's almost, well, jarring then, isn't it, to turn the page and find Kautilya's Arthashastra. Zimmer dives right into this. I mean, it seems so pragmatic, even ruthless. A treatise on statecraft, war, power, politics. It feels like the total opposite of a spiritual quest.
It does seem like a massive contrast, yeah.
So how does Zimmer fit these two, like, seemingly opposite philosophies together in the bigger picture?
That's a brilliant point, and it's where Zimmer's insight is really powerful. He shows that while the Arthashastra is often compared to Machiavelli's The Prince, it's got that stark worldly wisdom. It serves a vital societal function.
Okay, how so?
It's the practical manual, basically, for maintaining social order, for ensuring that the Dharma, the righteous duty of the state itself, can be upheld. And that, in turn, provides a stable foundation, a platform upon which individuals can then pursue those higher spiritual goals.
Ah, I see. You can't build a temple on shifting sands, as they say.
Exactly. Really? You need that order first.
Okay. So from this solid worldly foundation, we then transition. We move to what Zimmer calls the philosophies of eternity, this radical quest for liberation.
Yeah.
And he starts off with Jainism. Tell us about that. What's unique about Mahavira's path here?
Jainism is, yeah, it's definitely radical. It's characterized by pretty extreme asceticism, self-denial. And ahimsa, nonviolence, is the absolute supreme principle. It extends even to the tiniest insects. It's incredibly rigorous.
Wow.
And philosophically, Jainism posits this eternal dualism between jiva, those are the conscious life monads, like our individual souls or life forces, and ajiva, which is all the inert matter in the universe.
Okay, life and non-life.
Pretty much. But what's really striking is how they see karma. It's not just a moral consequence, you know?
No.
In Jainism, karma is seen as this subtle, almost physical substance, like sticky dust. It clings to the jiva, the soul, weighs it down, and traps it in the cycle of rebirth, samsara.
Yeah, physical karma.
Yeah. So the path involves intense purification, trying to scrub off that karmic dust through ascetic practices. It's such an extreme path, it really makes you think about how urgently they viewed the need for liberation, doesn't it? And how difficult they thought it was.
It really does underline the importance they placed on freedom. Okay, so from that very intense path, Zimmer then guides us towards Samkhya and yoga. They're often paired together, right? And so Samkhya is the theory part.
That's right. Samkhya is the grand theoretical framework. It's another dualistic philosophy, but different from Jainism. It describes two fundamental eternal principles. There's prakriti.
Prakriti.
That's primordial nature or matter. It's dynamic, always changing. It includes everything from our bodies and minds, our thoughts, emotions, right up to the whole cosmos.
Okay, everything that changes.
Pretty much. And then there's Purusha. That's pure consciousness. It's passive, eternal, unchanging. The silent witness behind it all.
The witness.
Exactly. And in Samkhya, suffering arises because Purusha, the pure consciousness, mistakenly identifies with Prakriti.
Meaning
we confuse our true unchanging consciousness with our temporary body, our fleeting thoughts, our shifting emotions. It's like, imagine you're the light from a projector, pure light.
Yeah.
And you mistakenly think you are the movie playing on the screen, the drama, the action, the changing scenes.
Oh, I love that analogy. Okay, so that's the problem identified by Samkhya. And this is where yoga comes in as the practical application, the how-to fix it.
Precisely. Yoga, especially as codified by Patanjali in the Yoga Sutras, is the practical methodology. It's designed to help disentangle Purusha from Prakriti.
How does it do that?
Its core goal is summed up in that famous phrase, Sita Vritti Nirodha.
Okay, what does that mean?
It sounds complicated, but it essentially means stilling the modifications of the mind. Quieting the constant mental chatter, the emotional turbulence, all the stuff that usually clouds our awareness.
Like smoothing out a choppy lake.
Perfect analogy. Imagine trying to see your reflection clearly in a turbulent lake versus a perfectly still one. Yoga practices like ethical rules, postures, asana, breath control, pranayama, concentration, meditation, the whole eightfold path, they're all designed to calm that lake,
okay.
to allow your pure consciousness, Purusha, to reflect clearly, so you can realize your true nature separate from all the mental noise. If you connect this to the bigger picture, it's this incredibly sophisticated ancient map for psychological purification, still hugely relevant today for finding inner peace.
Absolutely. So we've looked at the intense discipline of Jainism, the dualism of Samkhya Yoga. Then Zimmer brings us to Buddhism. He frames it beautifully as a kind of middle way. How does he position the Buddha's teachings? Is it a solution to both extremes, like extreme asceticism on one side and just worldly indulgence on the other?
Yeah, that's exactly how he presents it. Buddhism, in Zimmer's reading, is this extraordinarily precise psychological analysis of suffering. It's not just presented as a religion, but as a deep understanding of the mind.
Mm.
The Buddha's own life story kind of embodies this middle path, right? He went from being a prince, having everything, to trying extreme asceticism, starving himself almost,
right,
before finally finding enlightenment under the Bodhi tree. That path was the middle way. And the core teachings, the Four Noble Truths.
Life is suffering. Suffering comes from craving.
Suffering can end, and the Eightfold Path is the way to end it. Zimmer shows these aren't just beliefs you accept. They're like a profound diagnostic tool and a therapeutic system for the human condition.
A practical path out of suffering.
Exactly. And key concepts like the idea of no self. Zimmer clarifies this isn't saying you don't exist.
Okay, good.
Huh, yeah. It's more the insight that our self isn't some fixed, unchanging thing. It's a dynamic process, always changing, interdependent. Like a flowing river, never the same water twice.
That makes more sense.
And nirvana is the goal, literally blowing out or extinguishing that fire of craving, which leads to release from samsara, the endless cycle of birth, death, and rebirth driven by karma and ignorance.
This journey through these different paths is just incredible. Okay, then we pivot again to the Brahmanical tradition, mm-hmm. especially the Upanishads, with that massive concept, Brahman. This feels like we're zooming out to the cosmic scale now, doesn't it?
It absolutely expands to the cosmic. This is where you get that radical teaching, Atman is Brahman.
The individual soul is the universal consciousness.
In its deepest essence, yes. The individual self, Atman, is identical to the ultimate reality, the universal consciousness, Brahman, that underlies everything. It's the ultimate non-duality, the ultimate unity.
Wow.
But then we hit this crucial, often misunderstood concept, Maya.
Ah, Maya. Often translated as illusion, right?
Yeah.
But Zimmer says it's more complex.
Much more complex. He explains it's not just illusion in the sense that the world isn't real. It's more like the cosmic magic, the divine art of the supreme magician who makes the one appear as the many.
That's beautiful.
Isn't it? He says, the world is God's dream. To be caught in Maya is to believe that dream, that appearance, is the only reality.
Instead of seeing the dreamer behind it.
Exactly. To awaken is to realize you are the dreamer, or rather, you are one with the dreamer, with Brahman. So our suffering in this view comes from avidya.
Ignorance.
Ignorance, yeah. Ignorance of this ultimate truth. The profound mistake of thinking our individual self, our Atman, is separate from the universal consciousness, Brahman.
That's such a powerful, almost poetic framing of Maya. Okay, so to complete this incredible tour of Indian thought, Zimmer brings in the Tantras. This feels like it brings everything kind of full circle, doesn't it? Back to the world, in a way.
It truly does. The Tantras are presented as a later, very sophisticated development. They integrate all that deep philosophical understanding, but combine it with really practical techniques.
Techniques for what?
For transformation. But the key difference is this path is often about transmutation. Using the energies of the body, of the material world, even things like desire and fear as actual fuel for spiritual awakening.
So not denying them, but transforming them.
Exactly. Instead of denying the world or the body, Tantra often aims for liberation within the world, finding the divine right here in the mundane. It brings the whole philosophical journey full circle, like you said.
Wow. Okay, so after this incredible tour through all these systems, why does all this matter for us today? What's the core message Zimmer really wants you, the listener, to take away from this massive work?
Well, I think Zimmer's first, maybe most crucial message for you is that Indian philosophy isn't just intellectual gymnastics. It's a practical science. It's aimed at actual transformation.
Not just thinking differently, but being different.
Precisely. It offers methods, real techniques for direct experiential understanding. It's about changing how you perceive reality and how you live your life, not just changing what you believe on paper.
And reading through it, a couple of other big themes really jump out. One is this unity underlying apparent diversity.
Yeah.
It keeps showing how these very different paths are ultimately heading towards the same mountain peak, you know?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But also, maybe even more striking, is the profound psychology of spiritual transformation. These ancient insights into how the ego forms, how we get attached, how we can find liberation, they actually predate so much of what we call modern psychology by thousands of years. How does that kind of land, you know, considering our Western focus on progress?
It fundamentally challenges it, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. It suggests that many of the deep psychological insights we value today, maybe think we discovered, were actually explored with incredible depth and sophistication millennia ago.
Yeah.
Zimmer really highlights how these traditions provide these intricate models for understanding how the ego gets constructed, how it limits us, and crucially, how to free ourselves from those limitations. It's a comprehensive framework for mental well-being that often goes way beyond just managing symptoms.
And Zimmer's writing itself is just filled with these memorable lines, these phrases that manage to distill really complex ideas into something powerful and, well, quotable. He was such a master with words.
He truly was. Like that concept we discussed, the world is God's dream. That's one that sticks with you. It's not saying it's unreal exactly, but that our perspective shapes its reality. It invites us to wake up to the dreamer within.
Yeah. And another powerful one is that truth is a seeing, a darshana that transforms the seer. It really emphasizes that it's not just intellectual agreement. It's a direct experience that fundamentally changes who you are.
Exactly. It's about that shift in consciousness.
And he often speaks of the eternal flow of becoming, which really resonates with that Buddhist idea of anatta, the dynamic no self. Mm-hmm. It reminds us nothing is fixed, which can be quite liberating.
Mm-hmm. And also the notion that the goal is not to escape life, but to experience it fully with liberated consciousness. That really comes through strongly in his discussion of the tantras, bringing it back to engagement with the world.
Yes. And maybe the most fundamental one, ignorance. Avidya is the root of all suffering. It clearly points to the idea that if we can illuminate our blind spots, understand our true nature,
we can fundamentally alleviate our distress. It puts the power back in our hands, in a way.
Absolutely. And these insights, they aren't just, you know, historical footnotes or philosophical curiosities. Mm-hmm. For you, the listener, the real life applications are incredibly profound, aren't they?
Oh, definitely.
Think about personal development. That Buddhist analysis of suffering, the yogic understanding of the mind's fluctuations, they give you amazing tools for developing what psychologists now call metacognitive awareness.
Which is basically
the ability to observe your own thoughts and emotions without getting totally swept away by them, to see them rather than just be them.
And think about that in terms of stress and mental health. The meditative practices these traditions describe offer really concrete techniques. Ways to manage anxiety, build emotional resilience, instead of being constantly knocked over by difficult emotions. You learn to observe them, understand they're temporary, and then choose your response more wisely.
And even in your professional life or ethical choices, that concept of dharma, of righteous duty, gives you a solid framework for making ethical decisions. And the yogic principle of acting without being attached to the results.
Ah, non-attachment to the fruits of action.
Exactly. That can foster incredible calm and focus, especially in high-pressure situations. You do your best, but you're not crippled by anxiety about the outcome.
And maybe most profoundly, reframing reality through that lens of Maya. Understanding the world as cosmic play or dream, that can seriously reduce how much ego you invest in life's dramas.
How so?
Well, it fosters humility, maybe resilience too, by helping you see your everyday ego, your personality, as more like a temporary role you're playing rather than the totality of who you are. This can free you from so much striving, so much fear of failure. It allows for a more peaceful, maybe even more purposeful way of engaging with everything.
It's just astonishing, really, how these ancient insights aren't relics. They feel like a vital, living toolkit for today, for balancing our busy worldly lives with that search for inner peace, for navigating the sheer complexity of modern existence. Heinrich Zimmer's Philosophies of India, it really does feel like a master key, something that unlocks the immense breadth, the incredible depth of this ancient and still very much living wisdom tradition.
And maybe that's the final provocative thought we could leave you with. Zimmer's work really makes you realize that the states of awareness we usually consider normal, well, they might represent only a tiny fraction of our human potential. Mm. So this deep dive, maybe it invites you to consider, what other states of consciousness, perhaps higher states, might be waiting for you to discover. And maybe more importantly, what practical steps could you actually take right here, right now, in your own life, to begin unlocking them?
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive and for exploring these essential ideas with us. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Accatra Foundation.